Morning, everybody. I'm Tom Hall. Welcome to Maryland Morning. For the Democrats in Vegas, it was all about the issues: gun control, immigration, income inequality, Russia, campaign finance reform, Glass-Steagall, and the merits of capitalism versus democratic socialism. No need to ask where's the beef. There was plenty to go around last night. Clinton and Sanders tangled on guns and agreed on emails. And Martin O'Malley was after that ever-elusive breakthrough moment. This morning, analysis from Dr. Sherry Parks from the University of Maryland, Michael Fletcher from the Washington Post, and Republican blogger Richard Cross. Then, a conversation with Sue Friedrich, an acclaimed filmmaker. She'll be in Baltimore Thursday night to present her movie about gentrification. Plus, Tom Pelton with the Environment in Focus and Nathan Sterner with your local news. That's all on the way after the national headlines.
I'm producer Jonna McCone. To catch the news, you'll need to listen to us live on Monday, Wednesday, and Friday mornings at 9 o'clock on 88.1 FM in Baltimore and Frederick, 106.9 in Ocean City, and streaming online at wypr.org/listen. Now, on with the show.
There's got to be a morning after. If we can hold on through the night, we have a chance to find the sunshine. Let's keep on looking for the light.
Hey, good morning, everybody. Big night in Vegas last night. Hillary Clinton, Bernie Sanders, Martin O'Malley, Jim Webb, and Lincoln Chafee were the hottest ticket on the strip. Even Wayne Newton took the night off to catch the first of six Democratic debates. For a morning after look at the proceedings today, I'm joined by Dr. Sherry Parks, the Associate Dean for Research, Interdisciplinary Scholarship, and Programming in the College of Arts and Humanities, and Associate Professor in the Department of American Studies at the University of Maryland. Michael Fletcher is a reporter at the Washington Post, and Richard Cross is a former press secretary and speechwriter for Bob Ehrlich when he was in Congress and when he served as governor of Maryland. He blogs at Cross Purposes and writes editorials for the Baltimore Sun and other publications. And we'd love to hear what you thought about the debate last night. We're not taking calls this morning, but we'd love to hear from you on Twitter or in email. Send us a tweet at Maryland Morning or drop us an email, mdmorning@wypr.org. That's at Maryland Morning or mdmorning@wypr.org. Good morning to everybody. Thanks, you guys, for being here. Appreciate it.
Good morning.
Good morning.
So it was, to hear it through the perspective of CNN, it was kind of like fight night in Vegas last night, the way they, you know, hyped the intro and all the promos before the event. So I'm loathe to say, you know, winners and losers and put it in those terms, but I'm going to sink to that level, Sherry. Let me start with you.
Oh, do we have to?
Yeah, just your general impressions about, you know, who shone and maybe who did not.
Well, I mean, you know, Bernie Sanders and Hillary Clinton emerged as they entered as the front runners. But I think the other people, I mean, Martin O'Malley showed up, and I think that was important. And I think some of the conversation got pushed in ways that were fairly new. I mean, we now, somebody's going to have to go look up what a socialist Democrat is and mm-hmm. and what
yeah, a democratic socialist.
Yeah, so a democratic yeah. socialist, I'm sorry, and what a progressive. And poor white people had a good night. I mean, I really want to, you know.
Poor white people.
Poor mm-hmm. white people.
In what way? Let's talk about that.
Well, they have been the invisible impoverished. The face of poverty for decades has been black people. Even, you know, when you think about Appalachia, that emerges as empty and invisible. There are bills that we've seen that have actually shown, you know, that poverty is pretty widespread across the country. But as the bills go through Congress, the images, the actual pictures end up being just black people. And last night, two of the candidates talked about the impoverished family. Hillary Clinton talked about her family, and Jim Webb specifically talked in a bit of detail about the poverty in his family. And they were trying to do the kind of the up from rags trajectory, but that meant that they had to talk about white poverty in a way that hasn't really been talked about very much.
You know, were they talking about black poverty at all, too? I mean, was that expense, you know, of talking about the
yes.
problems of urban America?
Yes. This was a very white debate for Democrats in ways that were a little bit bizarre. They were even all dressed the same. Did you notice? You know, the black suit and the white shirt. And then when Sheryl Crow walked out, I thought, well, you know, it's going to be easy for them to throw in a little diversity with a, you know, black singer. They're yeah. not hard to find.
And I think DeRay McKesson tweeted at the very beginning, is Beyonce not available?
Right, right. And, you know, and Sheryl Crow walks out. It was specifically Sheryl Crow with her style of music. It's, I mean, very white.
Yep.
And she had on a white shirt and black pants. And I thought, wait a minute, if they really wanted to emphasize the sameness, they really did visually.
Yeah.
And so, yes, it was at the expense of any other type of poverty of color.
Yeah, interesting optics for sure. Richard Cross, despite all the hype and, you know, the way they, you know, these promos on CNN, just they were incredible, you know, boom, 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 Sanders, boom, 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 Clinton, you know, and then really fast, O'Malley, Webb, and Chafee. You know, and it was like, you know, it was fight night in Vegas. But it seems to me, at least, that they did have a pretty substantive conversation. This was an issue-oriented a couple of hours.
Well, I think it was. And in terms of winners and losers, I'd have to say Hillary Clinton was the big winner of the night, because all the coverage she's gotten up to now has been problems in her campaign. But I think she demonstrated last night that despite the problems, she's still the front runner. She came out seeming aggressive, well-informed. She showed her gravitas on the issues. She did it with a sense of kind of ease that I think made her kind of appear to outclass all the other people on stage. Bernie Sanders had his moments, and I think people who like Bernie Sanders watched that debate and probably like him even more today. But his ceiling and his floor is pretty set. I don't think he expanded his universe. The big loser, I think, is Joe Biden, because people, I think, were looking for towards like a death watch for Hillary Clinton, and she was going to come out and maybe have been rattled by some of the challenges she's had, and Bernie Sanders and her would get into this type of dynamic. But and her progressive credentials would kind of not project the way they should in a Democratic debate. But I think they did. And I think she accomplished what she wanted to accomplish. And I think the Biden conversation now takes a different direction.
And Mike Fletcher, Biden hovered above the event right up until curtain time. I mean, CNN saying that, you know,
we have a podium ready.
And this is Vegas. He could have just like parachuted in at the last minute and, jumped onto the stage, because they left open that possibility until the very last minute.
No, they absolutely did. But I have to agree with Richard here. I think he's kind of precluded right now. I think Hillary had a commanding performance. I mean, if you listen to the kind of the drip, drip, drip of the kind of the daily news cycle, Hillary has a way of coming off tactical, unprincipled, not quite moored to progressive principles. But I think last night she kind of explained herself. And she, you know, she's a person, I'm a progressive, but I'm a progressive who likes to get things done. And I think she kind of knitted together kind of the various elements, even her flip-flops, she was able to kind of knit together into kind of a coherent kind of tapestry. So I think she was the big winner. I agree. I think Biden's the loser. There's no opening for Biden, at least not as we sit here today.
Yeah, so that door might have closed a little bit for him, right? Here's a clip of Mrs. Clinton talking about this notion of being progressive.
Just for the record, are you a progressive or are you a moderate?
I'm a progressive, but I'm a progressive who likes to get things done. And I know how to find common ground, and I know how to stand my ground, and I have proved that in every position that I've had, even dealing with Republicans who never had a good word to say about me, honestly. But we found ways to work together on everything from reforming foster care and adoption to the Children's Health Insurance Program, which insures 8 million kids. So I have a long history of getting things done, rooted in the same values I've always had.
Sherry Parks, she used the phrase, "I don't take a backseat to anybody," several times during the event last night. And she certainly wasn't taking a backseat to Mr. Sanders in that response. That seemed pretty strong, pretty firm, and certainly the crowd liked it.
Oh, yeah. Well, she's the only woman there. And so that's the role she has to play to show that I am, you know, I entered this arena as the wife of somebody and as the fourth person for Barack Obama. And I don't take a back seat is very engendered, is a very gendered phrase. I am not standing behind. I think it's very interesting that phrase, I am a progressive, because the word progressive hasn't been shaken around the way liberal has, but it's left of liberal. And so here, this is the field actually moving slightly to the left. And for her to say in the way she did, I am a progressive, was, I think, a very interesting moment.
Because Richard Cross, the Republican strategy, certainly in the last two election cycles against President Obama, has been that the L word is, you know, horrible. And people were, Republicans were happy to tout that and tout Democrats as hopeless spend and tax liberals. Do you think Mrs. Clinton was able to defuse that kind of attack should she make it to the general election?
Well, if she makes it to the general election, I think that Republican attack on liberalism and progressivism and where you could get all the money to pay for all these great programs is going to come back. But in terms of the immediate task ahead of her, the primaries, I think it suits her well. And I think her concern right now among progressives is Sanders. And I think she needed to kind of assert herself in her progressivism and her history of being a progressive in a way that countered him and had people take another look at her.
And Mike Fletcher, you know, you've covered Washington for a long time. Folks at your newspaper, the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, the major print publications in the country have had this narrative about Mrs. Clinton as being a chameleon. I mean, she will say whatever audience, what she's talking to, wants to hear. Is that going to stick with her? Or do statements like that help to?
I mean, Anderson Cooper hit her as directly as you can with that question at the very, you know, start of the debate last night. And I think she parried that pretty well. I mean, because you had these kind of stark kind of flip-flops that were laid out in front of the audience. And she was able to sort of explain that, you know, you evolve on some issues and other issues. You know, you learn more about this and you do that. And it, I think, came off in a way that, again, somehow she managed to make that sound like a principled thing and not an opportunistic thing. So I think, you know, I think she really helped herself there.
Yeah, sure.
And that was one of the differences between this debate and I think previous debates is that she said, I get to change and learn. And actually, Martin O'Malley said the same thing. I get to change and learn. And flip-flopping has been a problem, that idea that you never get to grow and change. And that may be one, if it lasts, one of the major shifts that we have leaders that actually get to grow and change, which sounds very simplistic, but it has been an issue and a problem.
Sure. And heretofore, nobody's really been able to overcome that label, the flip-floppers. I mean, look at Mr. Kerry in his election, you know, years ago. I mean, he just wasn't able to, it was a steel wall. He just couldn't get over it. But maybe Mrs. Clinton has found the magic rhetoric here. Richard Cross, what do you think?
I think she's, perhaps, but I think what's really interesting is that she's kind of brought out this new rhetoric in a way where it seemed, sometimes I'm hesitant to use this term with Mrs. Clinton, authentic, and it seemed like representative of who she is and what she believes. And I think that's one of the reasons she did so well last night.
All right. Well, we are going to take up this conversation further after a break for the news. We'll be back after that break with more on the debates and where both the campaigns on both sides, all of the campaigns rather, on both sides are headed. By the way, we promised an update on the Man Booker Prize after the interview we aired Monday with Ann Tyler, the Baltimore author who was shortlisted for the prize. The winner was announced yesterday and did not win. The prize went to a Jamaican author, Marlon James, for his novel, A Brief History of Seven Killings. It's about the attempted assassination of reggae singer Bob Marley in the 1970s. He is the first Jamaican author to win the coveted prize, and we congratulate him. It's Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. Stick around. Here's Nathan Sterner.
Thanks, Tom. You're listening to the Maryland Morning Podcast, a service of your public radio, WYPR, in Baltimore. Find more podcasts at WYPR.org and tell us what you think by email, mdmorning@WYPR.org. Now, back to the podcast.
And good morning. I'm Tom Hall on 88.1. It's Maryland Morning. Welcome back to our analysis of the first Democratic debate last night. Joining me in the studio are Dr. Sherry Parks, the Associate Dean for Research, Interdisciplinary Scholarship and Programming in the College of Arts and Humanities, and Associate Professor in the Department of American Studies at the University of Maryland. Michael Fletcher is a reporter at the Washington Post, and Richard Cross is here as well. He's a former press secretary and speechwriter for Bob Ehrlich. He blogs at Cross Purposes. So, Mike Fletcher, Jimmy Carter, Bill Clinton, as governors, Barack Obama in 2007, all introduced themselves to the public pretty successfully when they were starting. You know, there was the man from Plains, and Clinton was the, you know, from a place called Hope. Mm-hmm. How did Martin O'Malley do introducing himself to the national audience?
I think he was eclipsed last night. He made sort of a valiant effort, I think, to defend his legacy as mayor of Baltimore. He talked about, obviously, his experiences as governor and as mayor, but there was just no room. There was no room. I think Sanders and Clinton dominated that stage last night, and O'Malley, I thought he tried. He had that intense look on his face, and he was pushing on issues. I think he defended himself well when, you know, in the Black Lives Matter question, when he talked about at least his aims as with zero tolerance. But it just didn't feel like a breakthrough to me.
Yeah, right out of the gate, Anderson Cooper brought him down to Baltimore and the problems in Baltimore right. and the events of April as a consequence of policies that he had in place as mayor. He didn't mention Marilyn Mosby by name, but he alluded to her discussion of O'Malley. Do you think that threw him off a little bit? I mean, he wasn't able to go national at the very outset.
Right, yeah, but I think he defended himself well, you know. I mean, to sort of like take the narrative to like zero tolerance, like ignores why we had zero tolerance, you know. I mean, whatever you think of zero tolerance. And I think O'Malley was good in invoking, the horrible incident in Oliver where you had the firebombing and things like that. People forget, you know, what Baltimore was.
Yeah, the Dawson family.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, what a horrible tragedy that was. So I think he did well to, you know, sort of defending himself, but I think it limited him probably for a national audience.
Yeah, of course, a national audience has no idea about the Dawson family.
Right, exactly.
Here's a bit of Mr. O'Malley's performance last night.
We passed comprehensive gun safety legislation, not by looking at the pollings or looking at what the polls said. We actually did it. And Anderson, here tonight in our audience, are two people that make this issue very, very real. Sandy and Lonnie Phillips are here from Colorado. And their daughter, Jessie, was one of those who lost their lives in that awful mass shooting in Aurora. Now, to try to transform their grief, they went to court, where sometimes progress does happen when you file in court. But in this case, you want to talk about a rigged game, Senator? The game was rigged. A man had sold 4,000 rounds of military ammunition to this person that killed their daughter, riddled her body with 5 bullets, and he didn't even ask where it was going. And not only did their case get thrown out of court, they were slapped with $200,000 in court fees because of the way that the NRA gets its way in our Congress, and we take a back seat. It's time to stand up and pass comprehensive gun safety legislation as a nation.
So Sherry Parks, relies on a technique that presidents often use in State of the Union addresses, you know, calling out somebody in the audience. Yeah. Do you think that was an attempt for him to look presidential? What do you think in terms of his strategy with that story?
Well, oh, sure. I mean, because he doesn't pick a Maryland story. I mean, he moves it out of the state and picks a family. And he was on CNN this morning and had a fairly long interview where he says that the family called him, which, of course, makes him look leader-like. And yes, this is very much. He has to expand his legacy to beyond Baltimore. So he says at another point, you don't know Western Maryland, you don't know the Eastern Shore. Say, I know rural people, and so it is not just Baltimore. So he is trying to look beyond the mayor, beyond the governor to a country. It's interesting because he is, I think, the person that the media camera loves, and we know that about him. That, I mean, he is been deemed by women's magazines as physically attractive. You don't have to take my word for it. And he has a certain style that is Kennedy-esque. And so I think he will get probably more media play. He was asked the question this morning, are you running for vice president? And he did this nice kind of a sidestep, nobody runs for vice president.
Yeah, nobody does run for vice president, except there's a lot of speculation that that's exactly what he's doing.
Right.
Either that or a cabinet
position,
something. I mean, there's no way of divining that, obviously. But let's say, just in case, he doesn't get the nomination, does a performance last night position him well for a high spot in a putative Clinton administration, for example?
I mean, oh yeah, because he is saying, I respect Hillary Clinton. I've known Hillary, in another interview, I've known Hillary Clinton for a long time. I just disagree with her now. That's a very nice position for a vice president.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Let's talk a little bit about the sort of the way CNN handled this. Richard, Martin O'Malley got a total of 18 minutes of FaceTime, Bernie Sanders 28 minutes, and Hillary Clinton about 31 minutes. So Clinton, Sanders fairly even, and Martin O'Malley a distant third, but way above Chafee and Webb. How did you think the general, you know, flow of the evening went in terms of people getting to know candidates if they're just starting to pay attention to this race?
Well, compared to the Republican debates, where you have pretty much the universe standing on stage, it was an improvement, because I think everyone on that stage had their opportunity to talk about who they are and what they stood for and get into some of the issues that are close to them. Whereas with the Republicans, I think most of those candidates only had enough time to bring in their best one-liners and use them when they were recognized. So I think the timing wasn't a surprise. I mean, it was going to be a Bernie versus Hillary show to begin with. And I think Governor O'Malley did a good job, you know, trying to get into the mix. But it's as Michael said, there's just not room there for him, you know. And I think he tried playing. I mean, he got into the race with this kind of tacit argument that he was the progressive alternative to Hillary for progressives who didn't think she was progressive enough. Now, what I heard last night is he was kind of touting his record in Maryland. He's the progressive executive with accomplishments to kind of underscore things that Bernie Sanders doesn't have, but I don't think it was enough to kind of change the dynamic of the conversation.
Yeah, it kind of makes you be very sympathetic to the Republican candidates when you realize how hard it is to get a word in edgewise with five people on the stage. You can imagine how hard it is with 10 or 11. You know, you feel for Chris Christie, you know, and a lot of times folks don't spend a whole lot of time empathizing with Chris Christie.
I felt for Mr. Webb last night myself, yeah. And he was kind of visibly complaining about it. I don't think he helped himself either doing that, but he was, you know, you could see his frustration.
Yeah, it was an issue for him. I'm not sure was an issue for anybody at home. Well, speaking of issues, they talked about income inequality. They talked about Wall Street reform, campaign finance reform, college affordability, immigration, climate change, ISIS, etc. One of the things, Mike Fletcher, they didn't talk about was police brutality, which has been so much in the news in these last, you know, months. There was one question from an African-American about Black Lives Matter, specifically, I think, about that phrase and its import. But, you know, it was as if Freddie Gray and Trayvon Martin and the whole other long list of men that we've been talking about for all these months weren't on the radar.
Yeah, that totally surprised me. You know, we sort of got a little bit close to the issue with the first question to former Governor O'Malley, where the Marilyn Mosby thing came up, you know, and witnesses aren't cooperating with police now because of kind of the bad taste left in communities from zero tolerance. But that's as close as we came. We never had an open discussion about police brutality and what a president could do about it, let's say, and which surprised me because it's been such a big issue. It's a dominant issue, certainly for Black voters, and obviously Black voters are a huge part of the Democratic constituency.
And Sherry Parks, where does that come from? Is that because of Mr. Cooper's line of questioning, or is it a conscious, purposeful effort of the candidates to steer clear of it? What do you think the reason was?
It seemed like a rhetorical version of All Lives Matter. And there's poverty everywhere, back to the there are poor white people. It's a mistake, because if Black people stay home, the Democrats have a problem. And there wasn't very much last night for a Black person who cares about race to grab onto. And I think they were trying to avoid the unpleasant topic, because there's no win there for them.
Here's Senator Sanders talking about the issue that was fairly charged, pretty charged, before the debate last night, and that is the emails of Mrs. Clinton.
But I think the secretary is right. And that is that the American people are sick and tired of hearing about your damn emails.
Thank you. Me too.
You know, the middle class, Anderson. And let me say something about the media as well. I go around the country, talk to a whole lot of people. Middle class of this country is collapsing. We have 27 million people living in poverty. We have massive wealth and income inequality. Our trade policies have cost us millions of decent jobs. The American people want to know whether we're going to have a democracy or an oligarchy as a result of Citizens United. Enough of the emails. Let's talk about the real issues facing America.
So Richard Cross, you know, thank you, Bernie, and then Hillary's, you know, shaking his hand. Is it true that the American people don't care about the emails? The Republicans certainly care about it. The Benghazi committees certainly care about it. And it's a sort of standard mem for politicians to be asked a question they don't want to answer and say, well, people don't care about that. With all of the media coverage that these emails continue to receive, is it true? Is Mr. Sanders right that people don't care about it?
I think he is right. I don't think people really do care about it. The only way it becomes relevant in the presidential race is if there's an indictment involved. And if it's just kind of chatter on Fox News about the emails, or one story in one news cycle followed by another story in another news cycle, I think it will go the way of previous quote-unquote Clinton scandals. You know, a door leads somewhere, and it leads somewhere, and in the end, people just stop talking about it.
Yeah, I mean, Whitewater and Travelgate, and this will go. Mike Fletcher, do you think, does this end up in the trash heap of distant memory like the other ones?
I mean,
hard to know, I guess.
Hard
now.
To know, exactly, because you never know when they turn up an email that, you know, is the quote-unquote smoking gun or some classified information that was sent. But as it stands now, it just feels like more of the same. But at the same time, this has had an impact on the Clinton campaign. It's the drip, drip, drip of, you know, of kind of innuendo, if you will. And, you know, maybe there's something wrong there. And it puts her on the defensive. And I think it heightens probably the weakest part of her as a candidate, this idea that, you know, she's so calculating and she's inauthentic and, you know, everything is a parry. Everything is kind of, you know, a tactical move. So it kind of puts her in that position. So I think it hurts her as a candidate. So it does have an impact. And I don't think it matters unless you have something that becomes mm-hmm. a big issue.
Mm-hmm. Sherry Parks?
CNN quoted its own poll saying that 56% of Americans thought it should be looked into. And I think there's a difference between it should be looked into and we want to hear about it all the time. And so I think the media is pumping this up. But I agree. I think the American people would be happy to hear more about substance. And I think that was one of the strong things, that list of issues that you talked about. They actually talked about things mm-hmm. last night.
Mm-hmm. Dan Ewald sent us a tweet, said that all the candidates treated climate change as a legit and serious issue about which Maryland is very vulnerable, you know, obviously with the Chesapeake Bay and things like that. Richard Cross, do you think that they gave a, you know, is this a meat and potatoes issue for Democrats in general? It certainly is for the Republicans, who, you know, many of them sort of deny any human involvement in climate change. Did the candidates handle it well last night?
I think it's more of a boutique issue for Democratic primary voters at this point. And I think of the three candidates, I'd have to say Martin O'Malley probably handled it the best, because he kind of tracked back to his record and talked about things done in Maryland. I mean, it's definitely relevant to Democratic primary voters, and I think it was wise for all of them to bring it up. In the end, though, in terms of O'Malley, I just don't think it was a game changer. It helped differentiate him from the others.
Mm-hmm. Mike Fletcher, we just have a little bit of time left. Did Lincoln Chafee and Jim Webb move forward from here, or did their lack of ability to sort of break through last night, does that, you know, take them off the card from now on?
I mean, you never can tell, but from what I saw, they didn't help themselves last night. They introduced themselves to voters, but that was about it. Mm-hmm. They didn't have a lot of face time, and you just felt like in the conversation about the issues, they didn't break through.
Mm-hmm. Sherry Parks, Martin O'Malley, I mean, did he stay neutral? Did he come up a couple of pegs? I mean, where does he go in 2 weeks? The next Democratic debate is the 14th of November. The Republicans will be at it on the 28th of this month. What happens in the next couple of weeks?
I think he made a little ground. He's not one of the other three anymore. They're the other two, and he's kind of somewhere in the middle. Yeah. I think he made some great.
Yeah, so maybe he's in a different, he's sitting at a different table at the cafeteria here.
Slightly.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. All right, well, thanks to you all. I appreciate it. And we will have you back to talk about some of these subsequent debates. They're going to start coming fast and furious now. So here we go. The games have begun. Thanks to our panel, Dr. Sherry Parks, the Associate Dean for Research, Interdisciplinary Scholarship and Programming in the College of Arts and Humanities, and Associate Professor in the Department of American Studies at the University of Maryland. Your business card must be like an 8.5 by 11 piece of paper.
It has a lot of little print.
It's really great. Michael Fletcher is a reporter at the Washington Post. Now, I can get my arms around that, Mike. That's pretty straightforward. And Richard Cross worked in the Ehrlich administration. He blogs and writes editorials for the Baltimore Sun and other publications. Let us know what you thought of the debate and what you'd like the candidates to talk about in their next debate. You can tweet us at Maryland Morning or email mdmorning@wipr.org. Coming up after the Environment in Focus and a break for news, a conversation with an experimental filmmaker about a movie that she's screening Thursday night here in Charm City. It's Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. Stay with us. Here's Nathan.
Thanks, Tom. You're listening to the Maryland Morning Podcast, a service of your public radio, WYPR, in Baltimore. Find more podcasts at WYPR.org and tell us what you think by email, mdmorning@wypr.org. Now, back to the podcast.
On 88.1, it's Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall here with Nathan Sterner. Glad you're with us. The nomadic film group Sight Unseen hosts regular screenings of experimental, poetic, and nonfiction cinema. And tomorrow night, they're hosting Sue Friedrich. She's an acclaimed filmmaker who, since the 1970s, has been making films that blend narrative, experimental, and documentary forms. Her films deal with issues like feminism, family, sexual identity, and in her film Gut Renovation, the charged issue of gentrification. She made the film in 2012. She'll be screening it tomorrow night at Normal's Books and Records in Baltimore. She joins me on the phone today from her home in Brooklyn. Good morning and welcome.
Hi, thanks.
So tell us a little bit about the film that you're going to screen tomorrow. It's called Gut Renovation. This is a very deeply personal issue for you.
Yes, it is. And I think for millions of other people. But it began in 2005 because the city of New York passed a rezoning law, and it completely transformed the neighborhood that I was living in, Williamsburg, Brooklyn. And some of your listeners might be aware now of what Williamsburg has turned into, but basically it was a very quiet, small-scale neighborhood, mainly Polish, Italian, and Hispanic, and then artists were also living there. And in the rezoning, it turned it into a place full of, you know, 30- and 40-story glass and steel condos that cost $575,000 for a studio apartment. So we had been living there for 15 years when that happened. We finally lived there for 20 years because we stayed on for another 5 years. But we knew that we were going to have to leave, and I felt that I should record what was happening. So that was really the genesis of the film, was reading the banner headline in the New York Times that morning that they had done this rezoning. And I sort of went from there to making the film.
We have a little clip from the film. This is your speaking to one of the people coming in behind those shiny condos.
You may think it's funny, but you're the people who are coming and ruining our neighborhood, and I'm recording it. So, welcome to the neighborhood. You're ruining it.
Did the fact that you were out on the street with a camera, you know, day after day, I mean, did that retard the progress of it at all, when, you know, during this period when they were doing the building?
No, and I do want to clarify that scene, I'm up in my window yelling out, and they aren't people who are moving in, they were the developers. And the reason I want to mention that is that that's really who we should be talking about. I mean, people need places to live, right? So, you know, if people build buildings, then somebody's going to move into them. But it's the people who build the buildings who made this thing happen, and that was a group of developers. We, you know, constantly in the neighborhood back in the day, you'd see this, you know, gaggle of men in their black overcoats wandering around with clipboards, seeing what other piece of property they could seize, and it just drove me crazy, so I just yelled out the window at them that day.
So that leads me to the notion of the purpose of making the film. What did you hope to accomplish in terms of enlightening people about the issue, or expressing what you, you know, this very personal experience mm-hmm. that you yourself had?
Well, I didn't think that it could change the course of Williamsburg's history, because I've lived long enough to know that that would have been stupid to think. I lived in the East Village back in the 80s, early 80s, and then I moved out down to Chinatown, and it was going through a transformation, not to the extent that Williamsburg did. And I thought I would remember the old East Village, and when I went back, if old beloved stores were replaced, I kind of couldn't remember them. And this time I thought, I want to remember what was here. So it was partly almost just to document it, not to turn it into a feature-length film, but the more involved I got, the more it became a feature-length film. So to me, it's a record of how all of that transpired, so that it could be informational to people seeing it who might be going through the same thing themselves. And I've traveled a lot with the film in the United States, but also in Europe, and everywhere I go, it's the same thing. I go to Toronto, and there are like 400 artists in the audience saying, we lived in a big, you know, industrial building, and now this developer has taken it over and thrown us all out. I go to Berlin, they're like, you know, everybody in Kreuzberg is being thrown out. It's happening everywhere.
It's international,
so
yeah.
It's more just kind of evidence of this phenomenon that's going on all around.
What do you think you've learned then from doing the film and from talking to all these people around, literally around the world? Is there an accommodation that can be reached when people want to, you know, spruce up neighborhoods, you know, lift them up, make them attractive to people of higher incomes? I mean, in some sense, that's a good thing for some economically depressed neighborhoods. Where's the medium that could be struck, perhaps?
I think there are all kinds of ways that neighborhoods can be improved without this kind of rampant development that happened in Williamsburg. But the problem that we all face now is the extremes of wealth and poverty in this country. And so these people who have absurd and obscene amounts of money do control things and have so much more power to do things than the rest of us. So I think it's a very difficult thing to achieve if one wants to do some kind of change without this kind of change that happened in Williamsburg.
Folks who know experimental film and folks who know film, like our producer, Jonna McCone, who herself is a filmmaker, is a huge fan of yours, and you have a huge following among the aficionados of filmmaking. Can you talk about the tension between getting a viewer to notice the film and the filmmaking as opposed to getting to understand the subject you're undertaking? For example, gentrification is a subject in Gut Renovation. You know, in my other job, I'm a musician, and when I do a concert, it's partially about the composer, the person who's written the piece, and it's partially about our performance of that composer's work. Mm-hmm. And are you conscious of that when you're presenting a film, when you've shot all this tape and then you've edited into this finished thing? Do you worry whether people are going to be too involved in the filmmaking of it, or not noticing enough the filmmaking?
Yes. I mean, this is such a great question. It's also such a huge, complicated question, right? Because, you know, they always say that, you know, if you do something really well, people don't notice what you've done. They just have the experience, and they don't stop and analyze what you've done. So in a way, I would say I aspire to have it be so, the workings of it be so invisible that people just see it and go away having the experience that I want them to have. But that means learning, let's say in the case of Gut Renovation, learning something about what happened in Williamsburg politically, economically, all of that. But I also want them to experience the fact that it's not a conventional documentary. I mean, I have a few talking heads in it, but much of it is not at all a conventional documentary. So you're getting this information, but in a way which to me is much more playful, formally. You know, I do all kinds of funny things with text and music, and I intercut things in ways that aren't expected because I want there to be a certain amount of kind of surprise and change and variation in what you experience watching the film. Of course, when you do something about a topic as loaded as this, then most of the discussion is about gentrification and about developers, right? I mean, when I did the screenings at Film Forum, you know, there were people there from the housing office and the this and the that, and it was all about what's happening to New York architecturally and all the rest of it. And every once in a while, somebody would ask me something about why I chose to use the music in the way I did or why I used text. And I was like, thank you for asking about
right.
the form.
You noticed. You noticed.
I spent a lot of time working out the form of this.
Sure.
That's a constant preoccupation for me when I'm editing something, is to keep both those balls in the air.
The filmmaker Sue Friedrich, she'll be screening her film about gentrification in Brooklyn. It's called Gut Renovation. Tomorrow night, Normals Books and Records at 8 o'clock. We've got more information on our website, wypr.org/Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. Friday on Maryland Morning, more about movies. We'll talk to an expert in the art of the home movie, as well as the director of community engagement at the new Center for People and Art at the Baltimore Museum of Art. And Sue Friedrich, thanks so much for your time. I appreciate it.
Oh, well, thank you.
You can tune in to Maryland Morning here on 88.1 Friday morning. Until then, for Nathan Sterner, I'm Tom Hall. Have a great day.